Chapter 25. In February, I was sitting in our workshop with Koster for the last time. We had had to sell it, and now we're waiting for the auctioneer who was to put up for sale the fittings and the taxicab. Koster had prospects of a job in the spring as racing motorist with a small firm of car manufacturers. I was staying on at the International and meant to try to get some additional work during the day in order to earn a bit more. A few people gradually assembled in the yard. The auctioneer came. "Are you going out, Otto?" I asked. "What for?" "It's all out there, and he knows his business." Koster looked tired. You could not easily tell with him, but if you knew him well, you could see. His face looked even more tense and hard than usual. Night after night he had been out, always in the same neighborhood. He had long since found out the name of the fellow who had shot Gottfried, but he couldn't find him, because the other, for fear of the police, had changed his quarters and was in hiding somewhere. Alphonse had dug all that out. He was waiting likewise. It was quite possible that the other chap was not in the city any longer. That Koster and Alphonse were after him he did not know. They were waiting for him to come back when he would think himself safe. "I think I'll go out and watch, Otto," said I. "All right." I went into the yard. Our workbenches and the rest of the stuff were piled up in the middle. On the right by the wall stood the taxi. We had washed it clean. I examined the upholstery and the tires. Our jolly old milch cow, Gottfried had always called it. It wasn't so easy to part with. Someone clapped me on the shoulder. I turned round in surprise. An unpleasantly flashy young man in a belted overcoat confronted me. He blinked his eyes and twirled a bamboo cane in the air. "Hello, we know one another." An inkling rose in my memory. Guido Tease of the Augeika. "Good for you," declared the fellow smugly. "Met over this selfsame bus. A nasty piece of work you had with you then, I must say. All I could do not to land him a couple." Involuntarily, my face contracted at the thought of him landing Koster a couple. Tease interpreted it as a smile, and on his side disclosed a rather lamentable set of teeth. "Still, bygones are bygones. Guido bears no grudges. You did pay an enormous price for the old grandfather, though. Was there anything left in it for yourselves?" "Yes," said I. "The car is good." Tease gave a deprecating smirk. "If you'd taken my advice, you would have had more. And me, too. However, bygones are bygones. Forgive and forget. But today we can do the trick. We'll take it up to 500 marks, eh? There's not a soul else to bid. Agreeable?" It dawned on me. He imagined we had passed the car on again then, and he did not realize that the workshop was ours. On the contrary, he supposed we meant to buy it again. "The car's still worth 1,500, said I, not counting the tax. "Exactly," declared Guido eagerly. "We go up to 500, I suggest. If we get it, I pay you 300 cash on the spot." "Can't do it," said I. "I've got a client for the car." "In that case," he wanted to make fresh proposals. "It's no good." I walked across to the middle of the yard. Up to 1,200 he had a free hand. I knew that now. The auctioneer began to put up the things. First the fittings. They didn't fetch much. The tools either. Then came the cab. The first offer was 300 marks. 400, said Guido. 450, bid a chap in overalls, after a long hesitation. Guido went up to 500. The auctioneer asked around. The chap in overalls said nothing. Guido winked at me and held up four fingers. 600, said I. Guido shook his head and went to 700. I bid further. Guido followed desperately. At 1,000, he made imploring gestures and indicated with his finger that I might still earn 100. He bid 1,010. By 1,100, he was red and hostile, but still squeezed out 1,110. I went to 1,190, expecting from him a bid of 1,200. Then I meant to stop. But Guido was now furious. It annoyed him that, according to his reading, he was being squeezed out. And he suddenly offered 1,300. I calculated swiftly. If he really intended to buy, he would certainly have stopped at 1,200. Now he merely meant to drive me up, out of revenge. He supposed from our conversation that 1,500 was my limit and saw no danger to himself. 1,310, said I. 1,400, bid Guido swiftly. 1,410, I replied hesitantly. I was afraid I might be left hanging. 1,490. Guido looked at me, triumphant and mocking. He imagined he had salted my soup good and properly. I fixed his eye and said nothing. The auctioneer asked once, twice, then he raised the hammer. The moment the car was knocked down to Guido, his expression changed from triumph to utter amazement. Completely at a loss, he came over to me. I thought you meant... No, said I. He recovered himself and scratched his head. Damn. It won't be easy to persuade the firm. Thought you would go to 1,500. Still, I have at least pinched the old bus from you this time. You were meant to, said I. Guido did not understand. Only when he saw Custer coming did it suddenly dawn on him, and he ran his fingers through his hair. Good God! The car belonged to you? Ass! Utter ass that I am! Sold! Diddled! Oh, Guido, that this should happen to you! Caught by the old, old trick! However, no use crying over spilt milk. The wiliest dog falls for the easiest bait. We'll make it up next time. He sat down to the wheel and drove off. Our eyes followed the car, and we did not feel very happy. In the afternoon, Matilda Stoss came. We had still to settle with her for the last month. Custer gave her the money and suggested she should apply to the new owner of the workshop for the job of charwoman. We had already installed Yup with him. But Matilda shook her head. No, no, Herr Custer. I've finished. My bones are getting too stiff.
What do you think of doing, then? I asked.
I'm going to my daughter. She's married in Bunzlau. Do you know Bunzlau?
No, Matilda, I replied.
But Herr Custer?
Me neither, Frau Stoss.
Funny, said Matilda. Nobody knows Bunzlau. I've asked so many people, yet my daughter's been married there 12 years. To a clerk.
Then there will be Bunzlau, too. You may be quite sure of that, if a clerk lives there.
What I say. But it is funny all the same that nobody knows it, eh?
We agreed.
How is it you haven't been there all these years, then? I asked.
Matilda smirked.
Well, there was something. But now they want me to see the children. They have 4 already, and little Edward must come too.
I believe there's very good schnapps to be had around Bunzlau, said I. Damson, or something.
Nothing like that, said Matilda. As a matter of fact, that was the something. My son-in-law's a teetotaler, if you please. That's people who don't drink anything.
Custer fetched the last bottle from the empty shelf. Well, Frau Stoss, in that case we must drink a farewell schnapps together.
I'm with you, said Matilda.
Custer put the glasses on the table and filled them. Matilda poured down the rum as if it were running through a sieve. Her upper lip worked vigorously, and her mustache twitched. One more? I asked.
I won't say no.
She got another big glassful. Then she said goodbye. All the best in Bunzlau, said I.
Yes, thanks very much. But it's funny, isn't it? Nobody knows it, eh?
She waddled out. We stood around a while longer in the workshop. We might as well go too, I suppose, said Custer.
Yes, I replied.
There's nothing more to do here. We locked the door and went out. Then we fetched Carl. He was in a garage nearby and had not been sold with the rest. We drove to the bank, and Custer paid in the money to the receivers. I'm going to have a sleep now, said he. Will you be free after? I've taken the whole evening off today.
Good.
Then I'll be along at 8. We ate in a little pub in the country, and then drove in again. As we arrived at the first streets, one of the front tires punctured. We changed the wheel. Carl hadn't been washed for a long time, and I got pretty dirty. I must have a wash, Otto, said I. Nearby was a rather large cafe. We went in and sat at a table by the entrance. To our surprise, the place was almost completely full. A woman's band was playing, and there was great activity. The orchestra had colored paper caps. Some of the guests were in fancy dress. Paper streamers flew from table to table. Balloons ascended. Waiters ran to and fro with trays piled high, and the entire place was filled with movement, laughter, and noise.
What's on here, then? Asked Custer.
A fair girl alongside us showered us with a cloud of confetti.
Where do you come from? She laughed. Don't you know it's Shrove Tuesday?
Ach so, said I. In that case, I guess I'll wash my hands.
I had to cross the entire room to get to the lavatory. For a while, I was held up by some people who were drunk and trying to hoist a woman onto a table to make her sing. The woman resisted, shrieking. The table fell over, and with the table, the whole party. I was waiting for the gangway to clear, when suddenly it was as if I had received an electric shock. I stood there stiff and rigid. The restaurant sank. The noise, the music, nothing remained. Only indistinct moving shadows were there, but distinct, monstrously sharp and clear, remained one table. And at the table, a young fellow with a fool's cap awry on his head. One arm about a half-tipsy girl. Glassy, stupid eyes. Very thin lips. And under the table, bright yellow, loud, highly polished leather leggings. A waiter bumped into me. Drunkenly, I moved on and stopped again. I was burning hot, yet my whole body trembled. My hands were dripping wet, and now I saw the others at the table. I heard them singing in chorus with defiant faces some song or other and beating time on the table with their beer glasses. Again, someone bumped into me. Don't block up the passage, he growled. I walked on mechanically. I found the lavatory. I washed my hands and only realized it when I had almost boiled the skin off. Then I went back.
What's the matter? Asked Custer.
I could not answer.
Are you ill? He asked.
I shook my head and looked at the table alongside where the fair girl was still eyeing us. Suddenly, Custer turned pale. His eyes narrowed. He leaned forward.
Yes,
he asked quite softly.
Yes,
I replied.
Where?
I looked in the direction. Slowly, Custer rose. It was like a snake preparing to strike.
Careful, I whispered. Not here, Otto.
He made a quick movement with his hand and went slowly forward. I held myself in readiness to start after him. A woman clapped a green-red paper cap on his head and hooked onto him. She fell back without his having touched her and stared after him. He walked in a slow curve through the room and came back. "Not there now," said he. I stood up and surveyed the room. Koster was right. "Do you suppose he recognized me?" I asked. Koster gave a shrug. He now noticed for the first time the cap on his head and wiped it off. "I don't understand it," said I. "I was only a minute or two at the most in the lavatory." "You were away over a quarter of an hour."
"What?"
I looked across once more at the table. "The others have gone too. There was a girl with them. She's not there either. If he had recognized me, surely he would have disappeared alone." Koster beckoned the waiter. "Is there a second exit?"
"Yes, over there, on the other side, on Hardenbergstrasse."
Koster took a coin from his pocket and gave it to the waiter. "Come on," said he.
"Shame," said the fair girl at the next table, smiling. "Such solemn cavaliers."
The wind outside struck at us. It seemed icy after the hot fog of the cafe.
"You go home," said Koster.
"There were several," I replied, getting in with him. The car shot off. We combed all the streets around the cafe, wider and wider, but saw nothing. At last, Koster stopped.
"Vanished," said he.
"But that's nothing. We'll get him sooner or later now."
"Otto," said I. "We ought to drop it."
He looked at me.
"Gottfried's dead," said I,
and marveled myself at what I was saying. "It won't bring him to life again." Koster still looked at me.
"Bob," he replied slowly, "I don't even know how many men I've killed. But I remember shooting down a young Englishman. He had a stoppage and couldn't do a thing more. I was a few yards away from him in my machine and saw his terrified baby face with the fear in his eyes quite distinctly. It was his first flight, so I learned after, and he was barely 18. And into that terrified, helpless, pretty baby face, at point-blank range, I pumped a burst with my machine gun so that his skull smashed like a hen's egg. I didn't know the lad, and he hadn't done me any harm. It took me longer than usual to get over that, and to quiet my conscience with the bloody recipe, war is war. But if I don't murder the chap who murdered Gottfried, shot him down without cause like a dog, then I tell you, that affair with the Englishman was an abominable crime. Don't you agree?"
"Yes," said I. "And now you go home. I must see it to an end. It's like a wall. I can't go on until it's away. I'm not going home, Otto. If that's the way of it, we're sticking together."
"Rubbish," said he impatiently. "I can't use you."
He raised a hand as he saw me about to speak. "I'll take care. I'll get him alone, without the others, entirely alone. Don't worry." He pushed me impatiently from the seat and immediately raced off. I realized that nothing could stop him now. I realized, too, why he had not taken me. Because of Pat. Gottfried, he would have taken. I went to Alphonse. He was the only one I could talk to. I wanted his advice, if we could do anything. But Alphonse was not there. A sleepy girl told me he had gone to a meeting an hour before. I sat at a table to wait. The place was empty. Only a small electric globe was burning over the bar. The girl had sat down to sleep again. I thought of Otto and Gottfried. I looked out the window at the street, becoming lighter from the full moon now rising over the roofs. I thought of the grave with the black wooden cross and the steel helmet on top. And suddenly I found I was crying. I wiped the drops away. After some time, I heard swift, light footsteps in the house. The door onto the courtyard opened, and Alphonse entered. His face was shining with perspiration.
"It's me, Alphonse," said I. "Here, quick."
I followed him into the room on the right behind the taproom. Alphonse went to a cupboard and took out two old army first aid packets.
"You might just bandage me," said he, pulling off his trousers without a sound.
He had a gash on the thigh.
"Looks like a running shot," said I. "It is, too," growled Alphonse. "Get busy. Bandage away."
"Alphonse," said I as I straightened up,
"where's Otto?" "How should I know where Otto is?"
he muttered, squeezing out the wound.
"Weren't you together?" "No."
"You haven't seen him?"
"Not the faintest. Open up the other packet and lay it on top. It's only a scratch."
Muttering away, he busied himself with his wound.
"Alphonse," said I, "we saw the... you know, about Gottfried. We saw him tonight, and Otto's gone after him." "What?"
He was at tension at once.
"Where is he, then? There's no sense anymore. He must clear out."
"He won't clear out."
Alphonse threw aside the scissors. "Drive there. You know where he is? He should disappear. Tell him the business with Gottfried's settled. I knew before you. There you see it. Fired, but I hit his hand down. Then I fired. Where is Otto?"
"Somewhere around Mönckestrasse."
"Thank God for that. He left there long ago. But get Otto out of the way all the same."
I went to the telephone and rang up the taxi stand where Gustav usually hung out. He was there.
"Gustav," said I, "can you come to the corner of Wiesenstrasse and Bellevue Platz? Quickly? I'm waiting there." "Right. Be there in 10 minutes.
I put up the receiver and went back to Alphonse. He was putting on another pair of trousers.
"Didn't know you were on the lookout, too," said he. His face was still damp. "Would have been better if you had sat in somewhere, for the sake of the alibi. Maybe they will be asking after you. You never know."
"What about yourself?" said I.
"Ugh, what do you think?"
He was talking quicker than usual.
"Had him by himself. Waited for him in his room. Up in an attic. No neighbors. Besides, self-defense. He shot the moment he came in. Don't need an alibi. Could have a dozen if I want."
He looked at me. He sat on the chair, his damp, broad face turned toward me, his sweaty hair, his big mouth drawn awry, and his eyes were almost unendurable. So much torment, suffering, and love lay suddenly exposed and hopeless in them.
"Now, Gottfried will rest," said he softly and hoarsely. "Had the feeling he didn't rest before."
I stood mutely in front of him.
"Go now," said he.
I walked out through the bar room. The girl was still sleeping and breathing loudly. Outside, the moon had risen high, and it was very bright. I went to the Bellevue Platz. The windows of the houses gleamed in the moonlight like silver mirrors. The wind had dropped. It was perfectly still. Gustav arrived a few minutes later.
"What's up, Robert?"
"Our car was stolen this evening. I've just heard it's been seen around the Mönckestrasse. Can we drive over?"
"Why, sure." Gustav became eager.
"What isn't being pinched these days? Every day a few cars, but mostly they only drive around in them till the petrol's out, and then leave them standing."
"Yes,
it's probably that way with ours."
Gustav told me he meant to get married soon. There was a little one on the way, so there was nothing else for it. We drove down the Mönckestrasse and then through the side streets.
"There she is," called Gustav suddenly.
The car was standing in a dark, concealed side alley. I got out, took my key, and switched on the ignition.
"Okay, Gustav," said I. "Thanks very much for bringing me."
"Shouldn't we have a drink somewhere?" he asked.
"No, not tonight.
Tomorrow. I must get off at once. I put my hand to my pocket to pay him the fare.
Are you balmy? He asked.
Right. Thanks, Gustav. Don't wait. Au revoir.
What do you say to looking around to see if we can't nab the boy that pinched it?
No, no. He'll be gone long since, sure. I was suddenly in a frenzy of impatience. Au revoir, Gustav.
Have you petrol?
Yes, enough. Looked at that already. Good night, then. He drove off. I waited a while. Then I followed, reached the Munkerstrasse, and drove along it in third. As I came back again, Custer was at the corner.
What is it?
Get in, said I quickly. You don't need to hang around anymore. I've just been to Alphonse. He's met him already.
And?
Yes, said I. Custer got in without a word. He did not take the wheel. He sat beside me, rather huddled, and I drove.
Shall we go to my place? I asked.
He nodded. I accelerated and took the road by the canal. The water was one broad silver band. The warehouses on the opposite bank lay deep black in the shadow, but the streets were drifting pale blue light, over which the tires slipped along as over invisible snow. The broad Baroque spires of the cathedral towered up beyond the roofs of the houses. They gleamed green and silver against the receding phosphorescent sky, where the moon hung like a great flaming onion.
I'm glad it's happened that way, Otto, said I.
I'm not, replied he. I should have got him myself. Frau Zalewski's light was still burning. As I unlocked the door, she came out of her sitting room.
There's a telegram for you, said she.
A telegram? I asked in surprise. I was still thinking of the night. Then I realized and ran to my room. The telegram lay in the center of the table, chalky in the harsh light. I ripped open the seal stamp. My chest constricted. The letters swam, vanished, came again. I breathed with relief. Everything stood still, and I gave the telegram to Custer.
Thank God, I thought.
It was only three words. Robbie, come soon. I took the sheet again. Relief vanished. Fear returned.
What can be the matter, Otto? God, why couldn't she say more? There must be something to the matter.
Custer put the telegram on the table.
When did you hear from her last?
A week ago. No longer.
Put a call through. If it's anything, we'll go at once.
In the car. Have you a timetable? I booked a call to the sanatorium and fetched the timetable from Frau Zalewski's sitting room.
The next good connection is until noon tomorrow, said he. We'd best take the car and go as far as we can. Then we can always catch the next train. It will save a few hours, certainly. What do you say?
Yes, in any case. I couldn't imagine how I should endure the idle hours in the train. The telephone rang. Custer went into my room with the timetable. The sanatorium answered. I asked for Pat. A minute later, the matron told me it would be better if Pat did not speak.
What's the matter? I shouted.
A slight hemorrhage a few days ago. And now some fever.
Tell her I'm coming, I called. With Custer and Carl. We're leaving now. Do you understand?
With Custer and Carl, repeated the voice.
Yes, but tell her at once.
We are leaving now.
I'll let her know immediately.
I went back to my room. My legs were strangely light. Custer was sitting at the table writing out the trains.
Pack your bag, said he. I'll drive home and get mine. I'll be back here in half an hour.
I took the trunk from the cupboard. It was Lenz's with the colored hotel labels. I packed quickly and settled with Frau Zalewski and the proprietor of the International. Then I sat at the window in my room to wait for Custer. It was very still. I thought that tomorrow evening I should be with Pat.
and suddenly a hot, wild expectancy seized me, before which all else, fear, anxiety, melancholy, despair, vanished. Tomorrow evening I would be with her. That was an inconceivable happiness, something I had almost ceased to think possible again. So much had perished since then. I took my bag and went down. Everything was suddenly near and warm. The staircase, the stale smell of the landing, the cold, glinting rubber gray of the asphalt over which Carl was just approaching. "I've brought a few rugs," said Custer. "It will be cold. Wrap yourself well in." "We take turns driving, eh?" I asked. "Yes, but I'll drive to start. I had a sleep this afternoon." Half an hour later, we left the city behind us, and the immense silence of the clear, moonlit night received us. The road ran white ahead to the skyline. It was so bright we were able to drive without the searchlight. The sound of the engine was like a deep organ note. It did not disturb the stillness, only made it the more sensible. "You ought to sleep a bit," said Custer. I shook my head. "Can't, Otto." "Then stretch out at least, so you'll be fresh early tomorrow. We have all Germany to cross yet." "I rest like this quite well." I remained seated beside Custer. The moon glided slowly across the sky. The fields gleamed like mother of pearl. Now and then villages flew past. Sometimes a town, asleep, empty. The gullies of the streets between the rows of houses filled with ghostly, immaterial moonlight that made the night an unreal film picture. Toward morning it turned cold. The meadows were suddenly shimmering with dew. The trees stood out like molten steel against the graying sky. In the woods it began to blow, and here and there from chimneys streamers of smoke arose. We changed over, and I drove till 10. Then we had a hasty breakfast at an inn by the roadside, and I drove again till 12. From then on, Custer kept the wheel. It went quicker when he drove alone. In the afternoon, as it was turning dark, we reached the mountains. We had snow chains and shovels with us and inquired how far we would be able to get. "With chains, you might try it," said the secretary of the automobile club. "There's very little snow this year, but how it may be the last few kilometers, I can't say exactly. You may stick there, possibly." We had a big start on the train and decided to try and get right up. It was cold, so there was no fear of fog. The car climbed the zigzags like a clock. Halfway up, we put on the snow chains. The road was shoveled clear, but at many places it was iced over, and the car danced and skidded. Occasionally, we had to get out and push. Twice, we sank and had to shovel Carl out. At the last village, we got them to give us a bucket of sand, for we were now very high and were anxious lest the curves on the descent ahead might be iced. It was now quite dark. The mountain walls towered steep and bare above us into the night. The pass narrowed. The engine roared in bottom gear, and curve after curve dropped downward. Suddenly, the beam of the searchlight slid off the slope and plunged into nothingness. The mountains opened, and lying before us, we saw below the network of the village lights. The car thundered through between the bright shops of the main street. Pedestrians sprang aside, startled by the unusual sight. Horses shied. A sleigh set off down a slope on its own. The car raced up the turns to the sanatorium and pulled up in front of the porch. I jumped out. As through a veil, I saw curious faces, people, the office, the lift. Then I ran down the white corridor, threw open the door, and saw Pat. As I had seen her 100 times in dream and desire, she came toward me, and I held her in my arms like life itself, and more than life. "Thank God," said I, when I had recovered myself. "I imagined you'd be in bed."
She shook her head on my shoulder. Then she straightened, took my face in her hands, and looked at me.
"To think you are here," she murmured. "That you have come."
She kissed me, cautiously, solemnly, warily, like something one does not want to break. As I felt her lips, I started to tremble. It had all gone so quickly. I did not quite realize it yet. I was not properly there yet. I was still full of the journey, the roar of the engine, and the road. I felt like someone coming out of the cold and the night into a warm room. He feels the warmth on his skin, sees it with his eyes, but is not yet warm.
"We drove pretty fast," said I.
She did not answer. She just looked at me in silence. Her solemn face had a piercing expression. Her eyes were close in front of me, and it was as if she were seeking, trying to find again something very important. I felt disconcerted. I put my hands on her shoulders and dropped my eyes.
"Are you staying?"
she asked. I nodded.
"Tell me at once. Tell me if you are going away again, so that I may know at once."
I meant to answer that I didn't know yet, and that probably I should have to go again in a few days because I hadn't the money to stay. But I couldn't do it. I just could not, while she looked at me like that.
"Yes," said I, "I'm staying, until we go back together."
Her face did not change, but suddenly it grew bright, as if lighted from within.
"Ah,"
she murmured.
"I couldn't have endured it."
I tried to read over her shoulder the temperature chart at the head of the bed. She noticed it, swiftly drew the sheet from its container, crumpled it, and threw it under the bed.
"That doesn't signify anymore,"
said she. I noted where the screwed-up paper lay and determined to pocket it afterwards when she wasn't looking.
"Were you sick?"
I asked.
"A bit. But that's over now."
"What did the doctor say?"
She laughed.
"Don't ask about the doctor now. Don't ask anything anymore. You are here. That's enough."
She was suddenly altered. I don't know if it came from the fact that I had not seen her for so long, but she seemed to me different from before. Her movements were more graceful, her skin warmer. The way she came to me was different. She was no longer just a beautiful young girl that one must protect. Something else had entered in, and whereas before, I had often not known whether she loved me. Now I was conscious of it. She concealed nothing anymore. She was more vivacious and nearer to me than ever, more lively, nearer and more beautiful, more delighting, but in a strange way, also more disturbing.
"Pat," said I,
"I must go down quickly. Custer is below. We must see where we're going to put up."
"Custer? And where is Lentz?"
"Lentz," said I.
"Lentz has stayed at home." She noticed nothing.
"Can you venture down afterwards?" I asked. "Or should we come up here?"
"I can venture anything. I can venture everything now. We'll go down and then have something to drink. I'll watch while you drink."
"Good.
Then we'll wait below in the hall for you." She went to the wardrobe to take out a dress. I profited by the occasion to put the crumpled temperature chart in my pocket.
"Right then, Pat. See you in a minute."
"Robbie."
She followed me and put her arms round my neck.
"I wanted to tell you so many things."
"I, you too, Pat. But now we have plenty of time. We'll tell each other things all day long. Tomorrow.
It doesn't go somehow at the start." She nodded.
"Yes. We'll tell one another everything. Then we'll know all about each other, as if we had never been separated."
So we haven't been, anyway, said I. She smiled.
Not I. I haven't so much strength. It was worse for me. I can't comfort myself with thoughts when I'm alone. I'm alone. That's all I know. It is easier to be alone without love.
She was smiling still. It was a glassy smile. She held on to it, but you could see through it. Pat, said I. Brave old lad.
It's a long time since I heard that, said she,
and her eyes were full of tears. I went down to Custer. The bags were already unloaded. They had given us two rooms next to each other in the annex. Take a look at that, said I, showing him the temperature chart. It goes up and down. We walked over the crunching snow up the steps. Ask the doctor tomorrow, said Custer. You can't tell anything from the temperature alone. I can tell enough, I replied, and screwed it up and stuck it in my pocket again. We washed. Then Custer came to my room. He looked as if he had just got up. You must dress, Bob, said he.
Yes.
I walked out of my brown study and unpacked my bag. We went back to the sanatorium. Carl was still standing outside. Custer had hung a rug over the radiator. When do we go back, Otto? He stopped. I think I'll go tomorrow night or next morning, early. You stay here, though. How am I to do that, Ben? I replied desperately. My money will hold out only for 10 days at the outside, and the sanatorium is paid for Pat only to the 15th. I must go back and earn. From the looks of it, they won't be wanting any bad pianists here. Custer bent over Carl's radiator and lifted the rug. I'll get money for you, said he, straightening. You can stay here and don't worry on that score. Otto, said I know how much you have over from the sale, not 300 marks. I don't mean that. I'll get some. Don't you trouble about that. In 8 days, you'll have it here. Got a legacy? I asked with dismal cheerfulness. Something of the sort. Leave it to me. You can't just go away again now. Custer spread the rug again over Carl's radiator. He passed his hand lightly over the bonnet. Then we went into the hall and sat by the fire. How late is it actually? I asked. Custer looked at his watch. 6:30. Extraordinary, said I. I thought it was much later. Pat came down the stairs. She was wearing her fur jacket and walked swiftly across the hall to greet Custer. I saw now for the first time how brown she was. Her skin was the color of reddish bronze, and she looked almost like a young, very fair red Indian. But her face had become thinner, and her eyes shone too brightly. Are you feverish? I asked.
A bit, she replied quickly and evasively. Everybody here is feverish at night. It's only because you have come. Aren't you tired?
What from?
Then should we go into the bar? You know, this is the first time up here I've had visitors.
Is there a bar here?
Yes, a small one. Or at least a corner that looks like one. That's part of the treatment. Avoid everything that looks like a hospital. You don't get anything if it's not allowed.
The bar was full. Pat greeted several people. One Italian I liked. We sat at a table which had just been vacated. What will you have then? I asked.
A cocktail with rum. The sort we always used to drink at the bar. Do you know the recipe?
That's simple, said I to the girl who was serving. Half port, half Jamaica rum.
Two, called Pat. And one special.
The girl brought us two Porto Roncos and a bright red drink.
That's for me, said Pat. She pushed the rum toward us. Salut.
She put down her glass without having drunk, looked around, then swiftly reached for my glass and emptied it.
Ah, said she, how good that is.
What's this you ordered? I asked, trying the suspiciously bright red affair. It tasted of raspberry and lemon. There was not a drop of alcohol in it.
Very good, said I. Pat looked at me.
For the thirst, I added.
She laughed. Order one more Puerto Ronco, but for yourself. I don't get any.
I beckoned the girl. One Puerto Ronco and one special, said I. I saw that a good many specials were being drunk at the tables.
I might venture today, Robbie, yes? Said Pat. Just today. Like in old times. Yes, Custer?
The special is quite good, I replied, and drank the second glass.
I hate it. Poor Robbie. What stuff you'll have to drink here.
If we order fast enough, I'll come into my own soon, said I.
Pat laughed. Afterwards, with supper, I'm allowed to drink something. Red wine.
We ordered a few more Puerto Roncos, then went into the dining room. Pat looked lovely. Her face beamed. We sat at one of the small, white-covered tables by the window. It was warm, and below lay the village with its lighted streets in the snow.
Where's Helga Gutmann, then? I asked. Gone away, said Pat, after a pause.
Gone away? So soon?
Yes, said Pat,
and I realized what she meant. The girl brought the dark red wine. Custer filled the glasses. The tables were now all occupied. Everywhere sat people chattering. I felt Pat's hand on mine.
Darling, said she very softly and tenderly, I couldn't stick it any longer.